Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from the archives of True West Magazine, July 1989 edition. Annie Oakley, an enduring Western legend, by R. Douglas Hurt. Will Rogers called her the best-known woman in the world. Buffalo Bill hailed her as the champion shot of the world. Officially, she was known as Mrs. Frank E. Butler. But to those who watched her perform, she was Annie Oakley. By the time she retired in the mid-1920s, she had entertained thousands at home and abroad. During her career, Annie Oakley competed with the best professional and amateur marksmen in the world. She traveled extensively in Europe, where she met many of the royal families and accepted their hospitality. When she closed her trunk for the last time in that pre-Social Security age, she had accumulated enough wealth to live comfortably, a considerable accomplishment for anyone reared in poverty and denied a formal education. She was born Phoebe Ann Moses on August 13, 1860, the sixth of her Quaker parents' eight children, on a tenant farm near North Star, Ohio. Her tranquil life in the country, however, ended in February 1866 with the death of her father. 3 years later, her mother remarried, but Annie's stepfather died within a year. The family always was hard-pressed for money, and at about the age of eight, she was placed at the Dark County Infirmary. That institution provided a home for the aged, insane, and children, and she was to earn her keep by caring for the orphans. Not long thereafter, she was given the opportunity to work for a family by the name of Wolf, who lived south of Greenville, Ohio. Little did she know when she accepted the position that the next 2 years would scar her life forever. Soon after Annie joined the Wolf family, she learned that the lure of money and schooling were empty promises. Instead of serving as a hired girl, she was in every respect a slave. Her days were long and filled with drudgery. Often she worked to the point of physical collapse. The food and accommodations were poor. She was cruelly treated, sometimes beaten black and blue. One day, when the Wolf family was away, she found the courage to escape. She borrowed the train fare home from a sympathetic neighbor, and at the age of 10, began to take her life into her own hands. Upon her return home, she found her mother remarried and family struggling to make ends meet. Although she began at once to help with the household chores, she discovered that she had the ability to provide for the family table by shooting game. With a 16-gauge muzzle loader, she went into the woods with powder and shot and killed more ruffed goose, quail, and rabbits than the family could use. Soon she discovered that the general store in Greenville would buy her game for shipment to a restaurant in a Cincinnati hotel. Since her stepfather, Joseph Shaw, was a rural mail carrier who traveled twice weekly to Greenville, she had ready transportation to market. The hotel owner and his clients were well satisfied because her game had little lead in it. She shot at the heads. 5 years later, she paid off the mortgage on the family farm with her earnings. At the age of 15, Annie visited a sister in Cincinnati. Her sister's husband belonged to the Cincinnati Gun Club, along with the owner of the Frost Hotel, who bought her game. Both men soon agreed that a shooting match between Annie and a visiting marksman would be good entertainment for the gun club, hotel guests, and public. They scheduled the match for Thanksgiving Day, 1875. Frank Butler was her opponent. He was part of the Butler and Graham shooting team, which sought work in vaudeville theaters across the Midwest. The site chosen for their match was north of Cincinnati in an area known as Oakley. This was Annie's first experience shooting trap-released birds. After her 25th pigeon fell to the turf, she collected the $50 prize. Frank Butler, a 26-year-old Irish immigrant and divorcee, was more than struck by her ability with a muzzle loader, and in June of the next year, they married. For the next 6 years, Annie Butler stayed with her mother while Butler and Graham toured the vaudeville circuit. On May 1st, 1882, however, things changed, after which her life would never be the same. Graham and Butler were booked in Springfield, Ohio, for a performance at the Crystal Hall. Before the performance, Graham became too ill to perform. Rather than have the hall manager return the ticket money and Butler's pay, Annie took Graham's place. Without practice, she and her husband made all of the tricks but one. The finale required her to shoot the cork from a bottle, which her husband held in his hand. When the cork disintegrated, the audience broke into applause. The act went so well, and the audience was so receptive, that the couple decided to launch their own shooting team. Annie believed that she needed a stage name, and adopted that of the grounds, where she won her first match. The team of Butler and Oakley toured vaudeville and performed with stock companies. In 1883, Butler and Oakley joined the Sells Brothers Circus of Dublin, Ohio. During the spring and summer season, the circus crisscrossed the Midwest for a host of one-day stands. At a performance in St. Paul, Minnesota, she won the affection of Sitting Bull, who named her Little Sure Shot. When the Sells Brothers' enormous shows opened in Columbus, Ohio on April 16, 1884, Butler and Oakley were billed as the Great Far West Rifle Shots. In New Orleans that December, they visited another touring group known as Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, and they liked what they saw. During the next few months, they corresponded with Cody, who also had watched them perform. Although he invited Butler and Oakley to join his company, they refused because the pay was too low. Sometime before April 1885, however, Annie agreed to meet Buffalo Bill's show in Lexington, Kentucky, and to perform for 3 days. If the audiences liked her, she would be paid her asking price. If they did not, she would return to the Sells Brothers Circus. After her first practice session, Nate Salisbury, Buffalo Bill's partner and business manager, asked for a photograph of her, which he planned to print on $7,000 of advertisements. With that roundabout offer of employment, Annie's career took a new turn. Butler, himself an astute showman, recognized that she was now the star, and he withdrew from the act except as her aide. For all but one of the next 17 years, Annie Oakley toured with Buffalo Bill's Wild West. Everywhere she went, her marksmanship with rifles, shotguns, and handguns astounded audiences. She broke a half dozen targets thrown at once into the air. She shot glass balls which twirled around her husband's waist. She knocked the center from a playing card, and she shot an apple off her dog's head. She also competed in shooting matches on the side. This activity increased publicity for the show and enabled her to win cash prizes and to share the gate receipts. She was hardly a showman who lived hand to mouth. During the off-season, Oakley performed with traveling theater groups. In 1888, for example, she played in the melodrama Deadwood Dick or The Sunbeam of the Sierras. In 1887, Annie Oakley's reputation as a marksman was enhanced even further when Buffalo Bill took his show to England. Although she joined the Pawnee Bill exhibition the next year, Oakley returned to Europe with Buffalo Bill in 1889 and toured with his company through the 1892 season. Whenever she performed, wherever she performed, Annie Oakley attracted large crowds, accepted shooting matches, and enjoyed the applause. In many respects, the admiration provided the recognition and prestige which she had lacked as a child. Indeed, her past was never entirely forgotten, and during the course of her career, she gave free performances for orphans, both at home and abroad. In 1893, Buffalo Bill's Wild West made camp in Chicago near the World's Columbian Exposition. After 186 days in which Annie Oakley appeared first on the program, the show closed one of its most successful seasons. For the next 8 years, Annie Oakley toured with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, logging two 100-day seasons with more than 340 performances each. She traveled more than 10,000 miles annually, making stops in bustling places such as Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and New York City, as well as in quieter towns across the Midwest. Annie Oakley's touring, however, came to a temporary halt in late October 1901, when she was severely injured in a train wreck while the show was moving from Charlotte, North Carolina, to Danville, Virginia. This accident was so harrowing that her hair turned white, and surgery and several months of hospitalization followed. Although she once again was winning shooting matches by mid-1902, she never toured with Buffalo Bill again. Instead, she and her husband represented the Union Metallic Cartridge Company and the Remington Arms Company, and she starred in the melodrama The Western Girl, which played Peterson and Atlantic City, New Jersey, in 1902. From 1903 until 1911, Annie Oakley competed in shooting matches and toured for the cartridge and arms companies. Then in 1911, a yearning for the arena led her to join the Young Buffalo Wild West show. Although this company was only a semi-successful replica of Buffalo Bill's show, Oakley drew viewers who now brought their children to see a performer they too had seen as children. At 51 years of age, Annie Oakley still was a sure shot. After the 1912 season, she left the Young Buffalo Wild West show and moved with her husband to a new house near Hambrooks Bay, Maryland, where they intended to retire. The performing urge, however, still was too strong to resist. And in 1915, she and her husband moved to the Carolina Hotel at Pinehurst, North Carolina. She managed the skeet range there, gave shooting lessons to the women guests, and held exhibitions. For relaxation, she went quail hunting. The work occupied her winters for the next 7 years, while the couple spent their summers at the Wentworth Hotel near Portsmouth, New Hampshire. At that time, one reporter wrote that her name was a synonym for cool and accurate fire, rifle, pistol, shotgun, standing, running, kneeling, sleeping, upside down at any target, from a moonbeam to a meteorite. An automobile accident in November 1922, however, left her seriously injured. In Florida, where she lived between 1922 and 1926, the climate helped her recover sufficiently to continue public performances, but she never fully regained health. In 1925, she competed for the last time in the Grand American Trap Shoot in Vidalia, Ohio. She died of pernicious anemia on November 3rd of the next year in Greenville, Ohio. Today, the name Annie Oakley still conjures thoughts of a dazzling sure shot, although most people cannot place her in the proper context of time and place. Still, the recognition of her name is an indication of the mark which she left on the American public. In an age when women seldom attracted attention, Annie Oakley became a household word, both at home and abroad. While she was an entertainer at a time when showmen generally were not considered respectable people, she won the admiration of thousands based on her marksmanship and her quiet, good-natured personality. Her life was glamorous but hard. Living under a canvas tent for most of the year and performing at one-stop stands across the country required stamina and an intense desire to excel that few can match. Annie was content, however, to do that which she did best, shoot, no matter what the personal cost. Whether she wielded a shotgun, rifle, or revolver, Annie Oakley had the uncanny ability to hit whatever she aimed at. Skills such as this not only demands long hours of practice, but also requires superb coordination, flexibility, agility, discipline, and a steady hand, particularly when shooting at a target held only inches from someone's head. The audience, of course, loved her. For them, she was not only an attractive woman, but one who did something far better than anyone else while performing with seemingly effortless skill. They did not know about the professionalism, however, that went into her performances, the tricks of the trade which helped her endure consistent success without cheating the audience. Her shells, for example, were loaded each day so that adjustments could be made to compensate for weather conditions. Her attire was made to look like buckskinned, but the broadcloth enabled greater freedom of movement. With her husband's aid, she worked constantly to add new features to her act so that a viewer never saw the same performance twice. She was a showman, too, who knew how to win the greatest applause from an audience. For example, she sometimes missed a shot in her act only to successfully complete it upon the second try, thereby gaining the greater appreciation from the audience for the achievement of a difficult feat. She did not, however, use wires, strings, or sleight of hand to make the audience believe she hit her target. Some trick shooters used cartridges filled with shot when the audience believed they were firing bullets, thereby making shotguns from their rifles. Whenever Annie Oakley used that method, she informed the audience that she was doing so. She was an honest performer. When she shot a cigarette from someone's mouth, split the thin edge of a playing card, or knocked a coin from between her husband's thumb and finger at 30 paces, a real bullet struck the target. Annie Oakley made her reputation in an age when the Wild West was becoming the New West. In an increasingly industrial and urbanized society, Annie Oakley represented the America of a bygone age. Together with Buffalo Bill, cowboys and Indians, and trick shooting, she helped give people a glimpse of American life which was once but would never be again. Many in her audiences would have been amazed to learn that she was not from the trans-Mississippi frontier. She did, however, have the unsurpassed ability to wield a gun, which was a symbol of the West, and it was a skill which the gunfighters of the cattle towns certainly would have envied. Above all, it was an ability which gave her fame and fortune. Not bad for a woman from Dark County, Ohio, who first went into the woods with a muzzle-loading shotgun at the age of 10 because she was hungry. True West Magazine, Archive Editions, July 1989. Plum Butte's Massacre on the Santa Fe Trail by Paul Hawkins. When Franz Hunting heard yells of "Indians! Indians!" he knew that he had lost a gamble that would cost the lives of his family. Hunting, an Albuquerque trader hauling merchandise along the Santa Fe Trail in September 1867, had requested a military escort between the Little Arkansas Crossing and the Big Bend of the Arkansas River. Because Hunting's relatives were part of the small wagon train, he was even more apprehensive about the danger of Indian attack. 4 years earlier, Hunting had traveled the Santa Fe Trail with his new bride, Ernestine. In late spring 1863, Ernestine described an uncommonly pleasant journey filled with lovely weather and blossoming wildflowers. Instead of riding in a ponderous freight wagon, the cherub-faced Mrs. Hunting traveled in a special passenger conveyance called an ambulance. Each morning, before starting on the trail, Ernestine took an early morning walk, then ate a good German breakfast of potato salad, ham, eggs, biscuits, and coffee prepared by her husband's cook. Later in the day, she ate oranges and sipped wine for refreshment. "But cake we have to imagine," she wrote in her diary. Nothing special happened during Mrs. Hunting's 1,000-mile, 5-month Santa Fe Trail journey. Unimpressed by the Indians she met, She remembered them as being like friendly children. Now, 4 years later, Ernestine Hunting had written her mother and brother to come and live with her in Albuquerque. A considerate daughter, Mrs. Hunting sent her prosperous husband to Dayton, Ohio, to help bring the family west. Little did she imagine that the trip would soon end in tragedy. From the Union Pacific Railroad head in Junction City, Kansas, Franz Hunting, an experienced Santa Fe Trail traveler, headed back to Albuquerque with his six wagons. The party consisted of Hunting's mother-in-law and her young son, Fritz, along with 6 to 12 mule skinners to drive the wagons. Hunting's relatives rode in a barouche, a kind of fancy carriage he had purchased especially for them. The barouche also carried extra ammunition. After a few days, the wagon train struck the Santa Fe Trail at Lost Springs. Barring accidents and bad weather, Hunting expected to reach Little Arkansas River crossing in 3 days. As a rule, Hunting knew that Santa Fe Trail travelers had few problems with Indians until they reached the crossing and moved west into Buffalo Country. As Hunting moved closer to the Little Arkansas crossing, he grew apprehensive. Along the trail, his party discovered numerous Indian tracks. The stretch of trail between the Little Arkansas and the Big Bend of the Arkansas was considered the most dangerous. Since 1864, Indian attacks in that area had been increasing. If attacked, Hunting and his mule skinners, well armed with pistols and Spencer rifles, would fight back. When Hunting arrived at the crossing, his anxiety was momentarily relieved. Black soldiers from the 10th Cavalry, commanded by Captain Edward Byrne, were stationed at the Stone Corral, a low-walled fort near the crossing. Hunting thought the soldiers could be counted on to escort his wagons to Fort Zara. But Captain Byrne flatly denied Hunting's request for an escort. Byrne's excuse was that his orders were to protect settlements. "The fool should know there are no settlements within 75 miles of this camp," complained Hunting. Explaining that he had an old lady along, Hunting asked Byrne a second time for an escort. Byrne still refused. Rather than safely await the arrival of a larger wagon train, Hunting hitched up his mules on the wagon of September 9th, and his six wagons started rolling towards the Big Bend of the Arkansas. The angry Hunting thought his party could join a larger wagon train at Fort Zara or Fort Larned. Hardly had Hunting left the Stone Corral when two army wagons pulled past him. The laughter of black women filled one wagon, and smiles abounded from an escort of soldiers riding in the other. They were all bound on a pleasure excursion to hunt wild plums. The captain had plenty of men to spare to escort his wenches on a plum hunt, but to protect the lives and property of travelers he had none, fumed Hunting. Whatever reluctance Hunting had about going on was lost in his anger towards Captain Byrne. Hunting's party continued alone. The day had started with rain, but by noon the clouds had cleared. Hunting could see Plum Buttes, a Santa Fe Trail landmark, 2 miles in the distance, but he couldn't see along either side of the trail because of a dense growth of sunflowers. In the soft, sandy soil of the trail, the wagons made little noise, and the only sound was the wind. Then one of Hunting's mule skinners screamed, "Indians! Indians!" 100 Cheyenne, Kiowa, and Arapaho warriors charged the wagon train. The howling warriors, who had been hidden behind hills close to the trail, attacked with headlong speed. Armed with rifles, pistols, lances, and bows and arrows, the war party swept through the wagon train's center. Their mounted charge carried along with it the carriage containing Hunting's mother-in-law and brother-in-law. The Indians brutally murdered the woman, the boy, and the barouche driver. After gathering their booty, the Indians set fire to the grass around the barouche, and Hunting's mule skinners, who had watched helplessly, fled the scene to escape the flames. 3 days after the hunting party left Little Arkansas Crossing, their mutilated bodies were found by Captain Charles Christie, a government scout from Fort Zara. A shocked and bewildered Franz Hunting escaped the Plum Buttes massacre, but the only life saved by his 15-mile ride to get help from the soldiers at Fort Zara was his own. According to Captain Christie, a dreadful sight met our eyes. On all sides were the evidences of a terrific struggle. Everything that had been in the wagon was strewn on the ground and stained with blood. The wagon had been burned, and what remained of it was riddled with bullets. Even the spokes of the wheels had been cut to pieces. Lying under the wagon, we found the body of a naked man, scalped and hacked in a horrible manner. That he had fought desperately where going down was evident, but if he had killed any of them, the Indians had carried away the bodies, as none were lying around. Hidden among the feathers in the ticking of a feather bed, we found the bodies of two women, both naked and disemboweled, and with their breasts cut off. Evidently, the mutilation of Hunting's young brother-in-law was so severe that Christie mistakenly identified the scalped and disemboweled boy as a woman. Christie and his Mexican assistant, Romero, had reached the scene of the massacre in a mule-drawn ambulance in advance of soldiers marching from Fort Zara. Smoke from the smoldering wagons and grass that the Indians had set afire still filled the battleground. To linger would be dangerous. Christie and Romero loaded the three bloody bodies of the hunting party into the ambulance and headed back towards the fort. Christie wrote, "When we were scarcely a mile on our return, there suddenly came streaming from a distant spot on our right a body of mounted Indians who rode galloping towards us, firing and yelling as they came. The Indians pursued the two scouts for 4 miles. Only by meeting the advancing soldiers, who were marching double quick, did the scouts escape unharmed." Santa Fe trail buff Ralph Hathaway of Chase, Kansas, still lives on the 111-year-old family homestead where the Plum Buttes massacre occurred. Hathaway says, "When my grandparents arrived here from Iowa in 1878, they discovered signs of a massacre. While breaking sod on the east side of the homestead, my grandfather, Father John Hathaway, turned up several articles, a pistol, a watch, and many pieces of hardware from burned wagons." William McGee, an early squatter on the Hathaway homestead, reported that in April 1874, he found broken and partly burned wagons, plows, barrels, tubs, boxes, and earthenware. And for miles around lay scattered unworn boots and shoes, crisped by prairie fires and the scorching sun, everything denoting the place to have been the scene of a general massacre, as a row of graves was visible for some years after near this spot. The hunting party were indeed victims of a general massacre. The boy, Fritz, was mortally wounded during the initial onslaught that separated the barouche from the other wagons. In the bloody frenzy, Franz Hunting saw a mob of Indians gathered around his mother-in-law and then heard the crack of a pistol shot. She was dead. Although the Indians who murdered the hunting party were never captured, Christie blamed renegades led by half-blood Charlie Bent. Charlie Bent's father was William Bent. His mother's name was Yellow Woman. Charlie Bent narrowly escaped the Sand Creek Massacre in 1864. He sided with his mother's people, the Cheyennes, and led a ferocious band of raiders in the war against the whites. Bent's renegades were mostly bloodthirsty, according to Captain Christie. They were the Ishmaelites of the plains. Their hands were against every man, and they were as quick to attack their own people as they were to fight the paleface. There was no torture to their fiendish minds that they could conceive that they would not carry out, laughing over their victim's agony and boasting to the poor wretch how brave their torturers were. To hear Franz Hunting speak, however, the military was to blame for the Plum Buttes massacre. compounded by Captain Byrne's refusal of an escort, Hunting believed the massacre resulted directly from Indian retaliation for General Winfield Scott Hancock's burning of a teepee village in spring 1887. During his eastward journey along the Santa Fe Trail to fetch his relatives from Ohio, Hunting had encountered Hancock's troops camped at Fort Larned. Hancock's soldiers, who included Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, were holding council with Cheyenne Indians to remind them of their 1865 treaty obligation to remain south of the Arkansas River. The Cheyennes had no interest in the treaty council and left, abandoning their teepees. Hancock sent Custer after the runaways and then learned that a Smoky Hill Trail stage station to the north had been burned by Indians. In reprisal, Hancock ordered the Cheyennes' teepees set afire. There was the cavalry with General Custer in command. There was artillery and infantry. It was an imposing array with bugles, drums, and banners. But the whole big demonstration was a complete failure, since it only served to make the Indians right good and mad by the burning of their tents, equipment, and utensils, said Hunting. Consequently, the embittered Hunting complained, they went on the warpath for about 2 years, causing a great deal of damage on settlements and the commerce of the plains. I myself later became a victim of their revenge. I did not reflect at first that while one part of the poor noble red man of the forest was being driven around in ambulances and drinking beer at Fort Larned with peace commission, the other half had ample time and liberty for an excursion to Plum Buttes to kill my relatives and rob and burn my wagons. While blaming the military, Hunting must have felt his own guilt for the deaths of his relatives. In his memoirs, he says that once the barouche in which they were riding was separated from the main wagon train, he could do nothing to save them. I had been so bewildered that I don't think that I knew what I was doing. The only thought that I remember afterwards was that I wanted to save the old lady and her boy. But a moment's reflection now convinced me that such an attempt would be sheer madness, particularly when I saw the Indians had the barouche with all of our ammunition in it, and we only had about a half dozen shots left in our guns. Such anguish as I then suffered, I had never experienced in my life. To stand there and look on powerless was terrible. Franz Hunting, prosperous Albuquerque trader, had traveled the Santa Fe Trail many times. In 1863, he and his new bride had crossed the trail with no problems. But in September 1867, the gamble Hunting took while traveling with his wife's mother and brother proved fatal. The bloody massacres of the Hunting party would be remembered as the Plum Buttes Massacre. True West, Archives, July 1989 edition. Go for the Gold by Arthur Shoemaker. Henry Grammer, one of the great steer ropers of all time, once told the officials of the Frontier Day celebration in Cheyenne, Wyoming, "We boys like to go to Dewey and go for the gold. All you have to do to get it is to win it." He was referring to the Dewey Roundup, one of the more popular stops on the early day rodeo circuit. Held in the bustling little town of Dewey, Oklahoma, it had grown from a humble beginning in 1908 to be on par with the big ones, Cheyenne, Pendleton, Calgary, Fort Worth, Prescott, and Madison Square Garden. Clarkson Turner, retired Osage County rancher, recalled his first roundup. "Way back in 1916, a kindly neighbor gave me a ride to Dewey, but he neglected to give me an admission ticket. I was on my own to get in, so I aimlessly wandered down to the barn where they had the roping horses. I thought I might wander by an open gate and follow a cow horse right into the show." The cowboys were cinching saddles, coiling ropes, and taking up a collection for something or other, as each of them had a fistful of bills they kept passing to one certain fellow. He didn't look like a roper. About halfway to the pens, Ben Johnson rode by, reached down and lifted me up and set me behind Henry Grammer. I told Henry my problem, and in a couple of minutes, I had a grandstand seat and a bottle of red pop. I then saw one of the wildest, roughest, and biggest paid-off rodeos that ever happened in this part of the country. It made a name and national reputation for Joe Bartles, the man who promoted it. In 1879, Jacob Jake Bartles, a Civil War veteran, settled on the banks of the Caney River south of the Kansas line in Indian Territory. He built a water mill and established a trading post that would eventually grow into the city of Bartlesville. After a few years, he moved his two-story store overland to some farmland he owned several miles north of the river. The new town site he named Dewey, after Admiral George Dewey, who led the U.S. fleet to victory over the Spanish Navy in the Battle of Manila Bay in 1898. Once settled at his new location, Bartles started construction of a three-story frame building to serve as the dual function of hotel and home for his family. It was a Victorian styling with 28 rooms, and when it opened in 1900, it was the talk of the territory. In 1908, Jake decided to host a grand reunion of his old comrades in the 5th Kansas Cavalry. To entertain the veterans, Bartles and his son, Joe, arranged for local cowboys to put on a riding and roping contest. Joe had brought in some of the wildest steers and horses he could find on the Bartles Ranch, and the contest was held in a field just behind the hotel. That first rodeo in Dewey was a smashing success, and the veterans had a day to remember. As it was, Jake Bartles went out in style, for he died 1 month after the reunion. Joe Bartles, bitten by the rodeo bug, and knowing a good thing when he saw it, threw his support behind plans for a contest the following year. This time, it was called the Dewey Roundup and held on July 3rd, 4th, and 5th. That first contest was memorable in the fact that a section of the temporary bleachers collapsed. However, there were no serious injuries. In 1958, Harry Roll recalled working with Joe Bartles from the beginning. He told why the Dewey Roundup was such a favorite with the rodeo cowboys and cowgirls. Although Joe resisted all attempts to turn it into a Wild West show, he wanted to keep it a working cowboy contest. He had quite a flair for showmanship himself. We really got big after we moved from Joe Knight's pasture to the new fairgrounds in 1914. We could then put on a show in front of a permanent grandstand seating 7,500 people, and this didn't include all those without seats. Joe, with a big wide Stetson and riding a spotted pony, would lead the grand entry, followed by the band, color guard, contestants, and clowns. The one big thing that made our rodeo so popular was that the winners got paid off as soon as they won. Joe would ride out into the arena with a hat full of $20 gold pieces and hand them out. You never heard such whooping and hollering in your life. After the purses got so big, Joe had to give up this practice. The gold got too heavy. From all across the West, top hands traveled to Dewey year after year. Clay McGonigal, Tom and Henry Grammer, Bill Pickett, Fred Lurie, Lucille Mulhall, Fred Beeson, Milt and Mildred Hinkle, Ben Johnson Sr., and Chester Byers, just to name a few. At the time of his accidental death in June 1923, Henry Grammer had only missed one Dewey Roundup and had already mailed in his entry fee for that July. It was the day of the 60 to 50 foot score, head start, for big 1,200 to 1,500 pound steers, and a roper with a time of 25 to 35 seconds was considered exceptional. The steers used in the bulldogging contests weighed anywhere from 800 to 1,100 pounds, with most at the heavy end of that range. They were wild and mean, and the early day bulldogger did not use a hazer as it is done today. Bill Pickett was always a crowd pleaser when he entered the bulldogging contest. As he grew older, The black cowboy gave up his technique of twisting the steer's head around and biting its lip in favor of the standard jump, twist, and throw. In 1920, Pickett and Jack Smith, both working for the 101 Ranch, rode to Dewey and signed up for the bulldogging. On the first day, Pickett placed first, Milt Hinkle second. Smith threw his steer but placed out of the money. On the second day, Bill lost his steer and Hinkle finished first. Smith again finished out of the money. The last day of the contest was hot and dusty. 15,000 spectators were crowded into the fairgrounds. Smith had drawn an ugly-looking steer with thin, sharp horns. Pickett warned him not to take chances, as the brute looked mean. As the steer broke through the barrier, Smith was after him with perfect timing. He was beside him in what appeared to be record time. He jumped, grabbed the horns, and brought the steer up short. He twisted, but the animal had a rubber neck. Straining even harder, Smith's sweaty hands slipped off the horns and the steer lunged to its feet. Before Smith could move, the steer lowered its head, pierced him through his right side, and tossed him in the air. Covered with blood, Smith kicked at the steer, keeping him away until Pickett jumped on a horse and drove the animal off. The cowboy was carefully placed in an ambulance, but died before it left the arena. His was the only death ever recorded at the Dewey Roundup. Tom Mix, a one-time resident of Dewey before he went on to travel with the 101 Ranch Wild West show, filmed one of his early movies in 1911 on the Moore Ranch east of town. That same year, Olive Stokes Mix, Tom's first wife, roped and tied a steer at the Roundup. For an added attraction in 1912, Bartles decided to promote a boxing match. Immediately, there was some local opposition to the affair, and a complaint was sent to the governor's office in Oklahoma City. Frank Canton, adjutant general, and a squad of state militia were dispatched to stop the fight. After it was explained to Canton that it was to be a boxing contest rather than a trot prize fight, he allowed it to go on. Harry Roll also recalled the time they received a tip that Henry Starr, Oklahoma's premier outlaw at the time, was interested in relieving them of the gate receipts. I believe it was a year or two before Henry was killed trying to rob that bank in Arkansas. We stationed about 30 men at intervals all around the place. Each man knew how to use a gun. Some had used them for the law, some against. Starr did show up, but quickly spotted the extra guards and made no attempt to rob us. Instead, he bought a ticket and watched the show. I knew him and he knew me, so we howdied as he walked by. Because of World War I, the 1918 Roundup was canceled, but Bartles did sponsor a one-day benefit rodeo, with the gate receipts going to the Red Cross. He passed out Liberty Bonds to the winning cowboys. Ironically, the steers were so big and fast that year that some of the contestants merely rode out and wasted a loop, admitting, "I can't catch him." For a rodeo with small beginnings, the Dewey Roundup was credited with a number of firsts. It was the first show west of the East Coast to have an outdoor public address system. It was the first rodeo to be covered by a rainout insurance policy issued by Lloyd's of London. In 1920, a small monoplane flew over the fairgrounds and took the first aerial photos of a rodeo in progress. It was circling overhead the afternoon that cowboy Jack Smith was killed. The show became so popular that the Santa Fe Railroad ran special trains out of Tulsa for $2.15 round trip. One year, several Tulsa men interested in staging a rodeo in that city asked Joe Bartles how he got his committee to work. "What committees?" he replied. "I look after everything inside the arena, and I have one man to look after everything outside. This way, I know damn well it will be done." In 1917, Harry Roll was with Joe when he went to Kansas City, Missouri, to stage a week-long rodeo. We held it in the old Federal League baseball park. Joe got C.B. Irwin to come down from Cheyenne with some Cheyenne Indians to put on an exhibition. C.B. was, for years, the highly successful promoter of the famous rodeos for the Cheyenne Frontier Days. Many of the cowboys who entered at KC had been back east in the New York Stampede held at the Sheepshead Bay Speedway in Brooklyn. That show had been promoted by Guy Wedick, who made the Calgary Stampede one of the all-time great rodeos. We did pretty well and made a little money. I do remember that Joe paid Irwin some $7,500 for the part of the show he furnished. The 1924 Dewey Roundup was the last one promoted and financed by Joe Bartles. It passed into different hands and continued until the Depression years, 1930 to 1938, when it was suspended, only to be revived in the 1940s. The fabled Dewey Roundup has now passed into history. It never regained the stature and color it had under the guiding hand of Joe Bartles. When he reached into his big white hat, that guiding hand became a golden hand. True West Magazine Archives, July 1989 edition. Great Western Gunfights. The Medicine Lodge Bank Robbery. April 30th, 1884, Medicine Lodge, Kansas. By Bill O'Neill. One of the bloodiest and most sensational bank robberies in the history of the West involved a lethal gunfighter named Henry Brown. Brown was born in 1857 in Missouri. Orphaned at a young age, he headed west when he was 17. For a time, he worked on a ranch in eastern Colorado. Then he spent a season hunting buffalo. In 1876, he killed a man in the Texas Panhandle, pumping three slugs into his adversary. Subsequently, he gravitated toward turbulent Lincoln County, New Mexico, where he fought in most of the skirmishes and battles of the Lincoln County War. Brown was a close companion of Billy the Kid, and in the aftermath of the Lincoln County War, he leagued with the Kid and other fugitives who formed a band of stock thieves. After the gang drove a herd of stolen horses to Tascosa, Brown seemed to exhibit a change in character. He pinned on a deputy's badge in Tascosa and later was an Oldham County deputy sheriff. Next, he was hired by Barney O'Connor, foreman of a ranch in Woods County, Oklahoma. But shortly, he was appointed deputy marshal of Caldwell, a wild trail town just across the Kansas line. Within a few months, he was promoted to city marshal, and promptly, he tamed the tough little town which had witnessed the shooting deaths of four officers. He imported a Texas hard case called Ben Wheeler, whose real name was Ben Robertson, to be his deputy. On New Year's Day, 1883, Brown was presented a new Winchester with a silver plate saluting his valuable services to the citizens of Caldwell, Kansas. And in the ensuing months, he killed two troublemakers in separate shootouts. Brown was married in March 1884. He bought a house and furniture, and for the first time in his life, went deeply in debt. Within a few weeks, Brown and Wheeler decided to rob the Medicine Valley Bank in Medicine Lodge, 70 miles to the west, and near the ranch where he had been employed by Barney O'Connor. Brown and Wheeler left Caldwell on a Sunday afternoon after having obtained permission from the mayor to spend a few days in Oklahoma in search of a murderer. The next day, they were joined by two cowboys, William Smith and John Wesley, and the four men headed for Medicine Lodge. On Wednesday morning, April 30th, 1884, they staked fresh mounts in a canyon in the Gypsum Hills, a few miles south of Medicine Lodge, and then they rode into town, arriving during a driving rain a little after 9 o'clock. Leaving Smith with the horses, Brown, Wheeler, and Wesley entered the two-story brick bank building and confronted the two men present, President E.W. Payne and cashier George W. Geppert, with the demand for money. Even though Brown had him covered with an engraved Winchester, Payne defiantly reached for a pistol. Brown fatally wounded him with one shot, whereupon Wheeler and Wesley pumped two bullets into Geppert, who had raised his hands. Geppert staggered to the vault and threw the lock, then slid to a sitting position and died. Gunfire erupted outside as Smith began to trade shots with City Marshal Sam Dinn and other citizens. With the town aroused, there was no time to force the lock, so Brown let a break for the horses. After a panicky moment of fumbling with wet leather reins, the outlaws swung into their saddles and spurred their mounts south down Main Street and set a course for the Gyp Hills. Across the street from the bank, a dozen or more cowboys with saddled horses were waiting for the rain to let up so that they could begin work on a large roundup. At the sound of gunfire, they mounted up and rode out in close pursuit of the outlaws. The furious pace rapidly exhausted Ben Wheeler's thoroughbred, and he abandoned his mount to ride double. The fugitives left the road and galloped west toward the hills. But instead of riding into the gap where their remounts were staked out, the outlaws mistakenly entered the only box canyon in Gyp Hills. Leading the posse was Barney O'Connor, who spurred his mount toward the mouth of what would become known as Jackass Canyon. O'Connor leaped off his horse and darted for cover as other posse members approached. With escape blocked, the outlaws dismounted and sought shelter over the grassy floor of the ravine. Several cowboys reinforced O'Connor at the entrance of the Box Canyon, while the others scrambled up to the muddy heights to gain sniper positions. A fierce gun battle erupted, but all parties had concealed themselves so well that no one was wounded. The outlaws were trapped, however, and to make matters worse, rain was slowly filling the canyon with runoff water. After 2 hours, Brown threw out his guns, asked for protection, and walked forward, followed by his three accomplices. In Medicine Lodge, infuriated townspeople met the prisoners with threats of lynching, and the outlaws were thrown into a log building under guard. The county sheriff and town marshal could muster only a single pair of handcuffs and one set of leg irons. On one end of the leg irons was fastened to Wesley's left ankle, the other to Brown's right leg. The cuffs were manacled to Wheeler's right wrist and Smith's left. The captives ate two meals during the day, had their pictures taken, and Brown wrote a letter to his unsuspecting bride, lamely stating that it was all for you, and that I did not think this would happen. About 9 p.m., three shots were fired, and a mob overpowered the guards and opened the jail, but Brown had freed himself simply by removing his right boot, while Smith had managed to slip his hand through the cuffs. When the door was flung open, Brown darted through the surprised lynch mob into an alley. Just as he broke into the clear, a farmer named Billy Kelly triggered both barrels of his shotgun. Cut almost in half by the double blast of buckshot, Brown crumpled into the dirt nearly 50 yards from the jail. Several other shots were fired into his body, and he died on the spot. When the mob turned toward Brown, Ben Wheeler seized his own chance for freedom. As Wheeler tore through the crowd, a gun was discharged at point-blank range. Wheeler staggered with the impact, and the muzzle blast ignited his vest, but he frantically kept his legs pumping. As he fled into the darkness, his figure was illuminated by his flaming vest, and he was followed by a fusillade of gunfire. A bullet ripped two fingers from his left hand, then a Winchester slug shattered his right arm. Still, he tumbled forward another 100 yards. The mob surged after him, firing on the run. Bullets chunked into his back, and he finally fell, to be pounced upon almost immediately by his pursuers. Back at the jail, Smith and Wesley also tried to escape, but advanced only a few feet before they were seized. Eager hands shoved them toward the creek bed a few hundred yards east of the jail, where a grove of trees flourished in the bottomland. The stunned, bleeding Wheeler was jerked to his feet and pushed alongside Smith and Wesley beneath a particularly large elm. Wheeler whispered a confession, then screamed pitifully as nooses were readied. His pleas for mercy were ignored. When Wesley was pressed for last words, in a trembling voice, he breathed that he had a mother in Texas and asked that she not be told his fate. He added that he had been born in 1853 in Paris, Texas, and asked that friends in Vernon, Texas, be told of his death. Smith disdainfully showed no fear. He requested that his horse, saddle, and personal possessions be sold and the money forwarded to his mother in Vernon. The nooses were placed around the three men's necks, and the ends of the 3/4-inch lariat ropes were tossed over a stout limb about 15 feet high. Wheeler wailed so loudly that he was heard blocks away. The three men were strung up and left dangling through the night. On Thursday morning, the bodies were displayed side by side in the lot west of the jail. Word of the lynching had spread rapidly, and all day the curious came into town to view the executed felons. Souvenir hunters stripped limbs from the hanging tree and sliced the three lariat ropes into small pieces. A coroner's jury decreed that the criminals had died at the hands of unknown parties. Later in the day, the shrouded bodies were laid into pine coffins, which were loaded into a wagon and hauled to the little graveyard a mile northwest of town. It was not considered proper to bury the outlaws alongside decent citizens, so a large hole was dug just outside the western boundary of the cemetery. Quickly, the four pine boxes were lowered into the common grave and covered with freshly turned dirt.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.